Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines, that looks at the big issues affecting Ireland and the world. We are the podcast of hope, Ireland's number one politics and social change podcast. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, academic, author, dad, runner, crazy person, and I am joined by an even crazier runner, dad, and banker, Tony Groves.
Slightly humbler, I'd say, you know, slightly humbler. That's some
humble
intro.
Humble is just for, we won't use any other words there. Humble, Donald Trump is a very humble man.
What is it? I'm a modest man with much to be modest about.
That's exactly.
Move along there.
Moving on. The earth is on fire, eco-anxiety, and what the hell can we do about climate change? Ireland and the rest. Lorna Gold, delighted to have you with us again.
Rory, it's great to be back good. In the hot seat.
Exactly. And getting hotter by the day.
Oh, absolutely.
Lorna, you're the author of Climate Generation, Mum, climate activist, leading
runner
as well. Yes. We're going to have to set a new bar for runners coming in here that we're blown out of the water by Sean Healy, who told us he was a marathon runner. And what was his marathon time, Tony?
2:15.
No way.
2:15.
That is amazing.
He now said he's 11th in the all time fastest Irish people to ever run a marathon or something. And he was in the top 10 for 20 years or some fabulous stat. Rory nearly died.
I nearly fell out of my chair that I wasn't standing. Sitting on. Lorna, you are, start off in terms of what's coming up, I think, because we don't want people to drift off halfway through the podcast and not actually be aware of why we're here for. There is more climate strikes coming up and protests. Do you want to outline in terms of what is coming up?
Yeah, so the big day is the 20th of September, next Friday. And that is 5 years to the day since there was the People's Climate March all across the world. That was the biggest climate mobilisation in history. And next Friday, it has to be even bigger, even better. The youth are leading the strike across the world, but they have put a call out to all of us to come out on strike. So in Dublin, what's happening is we're gathering at Custom House Quay at 12, walking to government buildings, and there'll be a rally there. And it's really a call out to everybody, especially unions, especially people who can take time as well off their lunch break, come out and join the youth. But there are events all across the country. Last count I did was around 100 events. So that's practically every major town in Ireland.
Yeah.
Not quite every crossroads yet. But you need to go onto a Friends of the Earth website to get the full details of everything that's happening next week.
So that's
the big thing. There's a list on, so that's foei.ie.
So even if people can't get into Dublin City Centre, you're saying across the country, people should look, people are gathering in towns, town centres, city centres, and I assume as well people will be encouraged to, you know, if they can take a walk off their work for half an hour, take a picture and support and put it up on social media, that find out whatever way people can express themselves.
Absolutely. To get your event, there are events everywhere, happening everywhere. So look up, find your local event, and if there isn't one, set one up. It doesn't take much. I know that a lot of schools, for example, are coming out to the big marches.
Yeah.
But there's other schools who, for various reasons, don't feel they can kind of take large groups of children off the premises. So they're doing their own events in school. So they might do a little kind of protest outside the school gates with parents, or they might decide that they want to do something around the green flag. There's a lot of green flag schools across the country.
Yeah.
The most important thing I think next week is to just to take time to really say to government, to say to each other really as well, this is a top priority. Time is running out, as we know, to tackle climate change. And it's just so important that people get out next Friday. The timing of it, just to give an explanation.
Yeah.
Like, so Friday is the 20th. On this Sunday, next Sunday, there's a big UN a youth summit at UN headquarters in New York, where the young people who've been out on strike are going to bring their kind of demands to world leaders. Then on the 23rd of September, so that's the following Tuesday, I think, there's one of these big UN climate summits at UN headquarters in New York. And that summit is really the objective of it is to kind of raise ambition of climate policies, because we know that so the Paris Agreement was signed in December or was agreed in December 2015. Things are not going well, as you can well imagine. The geopolitics that have shifted in the interim mean that for some people are saying Paris is dead in the water. Now, I don't think it's quite dead in the water, but this summit at the UN in September is just so key in trying to kind of say to world leaders, there is like a huge upswell of public demand for climate action, and that we're not going to take this kind of refusal to implement Paris lying down. So we're in really...
well, the only thing that frightens governments is feet on the street, and the idea that people won't actually vote them back in and they'll lose their seats, they'll lose their power. Hence why we see our own government, you know, with their new climate action plan. Since we spoke, they have launched that, and we've had Cara Ostenborg in, and we've spoken about these things at length. We tried to keep a focus on it in the podcast as something that we come back to time and again. But I'd love to get your sense of that, the ambition in that, because you mentioned critical to this is almost a global lack of ambition, and the fact that we say things like Paris is dead. Paris was almost just there was a lot of promise in Paris, but it has not really.
Yeah, I mean, well, what Paris did was put the emphasis back on individual governments, because Paris is just based on INDCs, which are the individually determined country commitments. So it kind of threw it back onto the countries to say, what are you going to do? And when you put it back onto the countries, then you're saying, well, what the countries are going to do depends on what the people want, really, or it should depend on what the people want. So it really does come down to, what are the priorities of citizens going to the ballot box? And I mean, I have to say, like, after the climate strikes in March, I was really encouraged by the level of interest, or let's say the fact that climate change became a voting issue for the first time ever. I've been in this game, as you know, for a long time. It feels like too long. And our kind of objective, like high level, was always to say, we need to get this into voters' consciousness. And in March, it was the first time it ever registered on the doorsteps. And I was hearing that from very different kind of perspectives, different political parties. And I think that's a factor of the climate strikes. And also the level of kind of consciousness that people are seeing the kind of impacts around them. I mean, you have to be fairly, let's say, blind almost, or like you have to be
willfully blind.
Willfully blind, yeah. I'm not.
But is there a danger though? Because we look at it already, and we see how Brexit's dominating at the moment.
Oh yeah,
that, you know, climate again, the economy starts, you know, reducing that. As what happened during the recession austerity, climate is just dropped as an issue.
Well, I was coming back to the climate plan, which was the question you asked me. I was just reading again the preamble to this morning. And I mean, it's brilliant on rhetoric. If it was to be judged on the rhetoric, full marks, they really get that they have lost a decade. So that was the lost decade, was like, and that we are laggards. There is no pretense on the fact that we have an uphill struggle and that we're really falling behind the rest of Europe on our climate commitments. But it's not, we can't judge it at this stage on the rhetoric. The rhetoric is definitely based on the science. Now it's the substance of it. And let's say there are a few positives in it, and there's a lot of, let's say, hot air, like, or re-kind of regurgitating
stuff that was
already there in the National Mitigation Plan.
Yep.
So the National Mitigation Plan had something like, I can't remember now, 200 odd commitments,
yeah.
Very few of which actually kind of could be judged in terms of concrete emissions. And there's a bit more detail in this one. I mean, what I think's positive is the governance aspects of it. So it commits to having a fully independent climate council, to having carbon budgets every 5 years, to moving the portfolio of climate change. So the mandate for climate action across all public, all departments of government, and moving that into the kind of governance of that into the Department of the Taoiseach. So it does move us closer to something that's more legally binding in terms of our ability to stick to our commitments as governments change. But, and it does have some ambitious figures in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the figures are like made people like fall off, like me fall off our chairs. Like 500,000 houses are going to be retrofitted by 2030.
Yeah.
Almost a million electric vehicles on the roads by 2030. And these are big figures. Basically an area the size practically of Wales, under forestry by 2030. These are huge figures.
Mm.
I mean, and having seen plans like this, not quite like this, but having seen plans before, I think it's about, well, two things I'd say. First is, like, it's short on the detail on how this is going to happen. And I mean, they would say this is a work in progress, but like the delivery mechanisms for all of this stuff, how's that going to, where are the workers and to do all these retrofits? Who's going to pay for it? It's very short on
We only saw two or three weeks ago that they had actually said nothing over the course of the local and European elections, but they quietly said to people, stop with the retrofitting grants, we're all out of money.
Well, that's it,
you
yeah.
That was an obvious one. We know the infrastructure isn't there for 500,000 electric cars as requires currently stipulated, as you said, and where is that going to come from? The onus has to be on these things. Like, these are job creators.
Absolutely. And I mean, and there are a lot of jobs in, let's say, a green economy, which is part of the kind of transition. But I mean, there's a few things seriously lacking in the plan. I mean, even with all these additional measures, and this is based on the EPA's own statistics, even with all the additional measures, we are going to get nowhere near the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions that are required of us by 2030. We're going to miss our targets for next year. We know that significantly. And even with all those different measures, we are still going to be seriously lagging behind the European target, which is 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. And I mean, the bigger context of this is, I mean, the reasons for that are there are very few serious targets being placed on the
big polluters.
The big polluters. So, I mean, the agricultural sector, we know, and I've got a lot of sympathy, obviously, for the farmers at the moment, and they are the victims, the small, in particular, the family farms that are in this system of pricing around their products. But there's no strategy to look at how do we diversify our agricultural sector? How do we wean ourselves off beef and dairy and onto something that's more sustainable, more a better use of our land that pays farmers to be the custodians of land, and then to be looking at other types of food production, because we know that's, we need to be going in that direction in the coming years. So there's that is completely lacking. The assumption in the plan is that the beef and dairy sector, the agricultural sector, is almost ring-fenced.
Mm.
So all the other emissions reductions have to come from elsewhere.
Mm.
And what it really means to me is, well, like, so even if we do all those other reductions in
which
our emissions...
Which we still should.
Which we should, of course we should. Yeah. But it's like a... it becomes a bit like a scattergun approach when you're not tackling the most, the biggest polluter, you know, and you're not kind of prepared to enter into that conversation.
And it's like in terms of, I think that space of the question of the conversation, it's like, well, here's our plan. You know, and, you know, we're going to, as you say, it's even it lacks ambition. But let's say it's saying we're going to do this and we're committed to this now. We accept there's a problem. But yet there's no real transformation. There's no real significant change in saying actually our entire economic model has to change if we're going to really address this.
Because exactly. the government's other big plan prior to this was their 2040 plan in Ireland 2040. Yeah. And sustainability wasn't actually in that when it initially launched.
It was an afterthought.
Where someone put their hand up in the room literally and said, should we actually factor in climate on this? And they all went, oh shit, redraw that. This is true. Yeah. This is true. No. I'm not making this up. And they went and they ran back.
And all the advertising they paid in newspapers and everything all, for that 2040
but
plan.
But 2040 made it quite clear that if we were to achieve what they said in the 20, it runs in contradiction to what later came out in the Climate Action Plan. Quite a lot of that is counterintuitive. The thinking is wrong, and it can't work that way. So we need to be serious in the Climate Action Plan, as I see it. As Lorna quite rightly puts out, there's a lot about mitigation that was already in the plan. I think it was something like 145 actions. I think were just rehashed and re-put into this plan. Second thing that was really important about that is there was no touch points. Like in business, you have to say, well, look, what was our goal? Let's touch base in a week, see how we're getting on towards
the indicators
that.
You there measure.
And
they say they will come because they want them done at departmental level. So in fairness, they're saying that has to be done
at departmental level.
So like, I mean, we can be cynical about it. And I think that there's reason to have that level of cynicism given this. And also to bear in mind, the state, in a sense, is running scared because, like, there's a court case on climate that looks at the last mitigation plan and the fact that it wasn't legally enforced. So that the judgment for that's next Thursday. So that's the day before the climate strike. So there's going to be a rally as well in front of the court, the four courts to look at. Hopefully the judgment will be in favour of the people of Ireland to say that we need more robust. And obviously what the government's trying to do with the new plan is saying, here's the new plan. It meets the standards that are required in the hope that the court case could be thrown out. There's a lot. My concern is that we're running out of time. And I think that if you look at some of the literature that's come out over the summer and some of the kind of things that have happened, not even just the literature. I mean, there's various books have come out, like Bill McKibben's new book, Falter. Naomi Klein's got a new book out, On Fire. David Grimes' book, The Irrational Leap. There's all these books coming out. And then there's the Uninhabitable Earth, came out as well. I can't remember the author, but, we really reached the point where we need something transformative to happen. And hopefully, like, I just think that Greta Thunberg and the climate strikers are like that tiny little spark of light on the horizon. But the transformative ideas need to happen as well. Like, so we need to look at what we have in terms of the climate plan and all its failings, but like, let's just get working on all the emissions reductions we can. But also we need the more transformative ideas to emerge. And I mean, that was to me the biggest disappointment in this plan. I mean, the things like circular economy were all like an afterthought. Like after the list of everything, there was like circular economy. And then like the bullets under that are like more or less will improve recycling. The idea of a circular economy, of shared consumption, of all these kind of bigger ideas around where we need to be shifting to get away from a systemic destruction of nature through individualized capitalism. Like, they're obviously what the government's trying to do is work within the frame of reference that it has, and to not address these bigger questions. I mean, the whole, I mean, I'm really fascinated by the donut economy, Kate Raworth's idea, of the, because it just makes so much sense. This idea that we have what planetary ecological systems that we need to stay within, and our economy should be looking to help us to live within that livable space. And then there's a social floor. So you can't, you have to look at both of these axes, the social floor, which is about distributive justice, and the ecological
boundaries,
the planetary boundaries. And this is based on really solid science, which requires people from different disciplines to all work together, like from a social science and economics. So, I mean, we urgently need like people of like different academics of different disciplines, policymakers who are in that space of thinking creatively, to think outside the box of kind of business
as usual. In terms of the circular economy, the, you know, and these ideas, what's at their core? How are they different from how things are now?
That the economy has to become something that's regenerative, that we have to wean ourselves off of the constant, let's say, impulse to purchase new products, which are basically an extractive economy. So basically everything we produce, we want it brand new.
Yeah.
We extract it. When in reality, they end, so that's a linear economy, because everything we produce, I always think clothes because like we're sitting in them. It goes somewhere.
Yeah.
The materials go somewhere, whether that's landfill, whether it's recycling.
Also extracted from somewhere.
And it's extracted from somewhere. And you can like look at all different types of economy, economic cycles, production cycles, consumption cycles, and then the waste. The circular economy has to put the emphasis on a high cost of extraction and minimizing the costs of reuse, so it's not just about waste recycling. It's about saying everything material that we have has a value, even when we have stopped using it for our little window of use. So it can be repurposed. And there's a huge economy to be developed in that direction. Our economy is not structured in that way because big brands, all they want is us to go out and buy something new.
And we think of, you know, the you know, largest corporations now in the world. Like we were seeing the launch of the new iPhone, for example, and how much, you know, extractive material has to be used because, you know, in every product has the inbuilt obsolescence. And as obviously as technology develops, there is a challenge in that.
Yeah.
But surely we should be looking, what you're arguing, and I don't know, was it in the report, you know, putting it out to corporations that you now should be designing products that are aiming, you know, to incorporate digital change rather than just building new products? Of course they're not. Like our entire economies, Ireland's corporate tax take is based on
planned obsolescence,
this constant consumption.
Infinite growth.
The infinite growth myth, of course, which is, and this is, you're absolutely right. I think that that's where our conversation needs to shift to.
It needs to be going to degrowth. The conversation needs to be going to circular economy, degrowth. And then the whole ideas of shared consumption. I mean, that's my PhD was originally on that whole idea of, the fact that there are, like, We are so consumed ourselves by stuff like that we don't need, and that we only need whether it's occasionally stuff that we, in the context of a community, can be shared.
Yeah.
But there are so many blockages to making that happen. I mean, there's brilliant examples now of things like the Library of Things. I talk about it in Climate Generation. The Library of Things is a great idea. We've got libraries for books, but like, why wouldn't we have a library for a lot of other things at a local level? But it goes beyond that. It goes to look at the whole fact that this whole idea of circularity is about shared goods. It's not, and it's about getting beyond individualized consumption, because that's limitless. Like, in a sense, the idea of what we're seeing now in the economy, I see, is like the kind of the madness of individualizing everything and making everything individualized, single use and disposable. Like, so if it comes right down to individualized, I mean, packets of, I mean, if you think of the biscuits that you get when you have your coffee, I love coffee, but like those little biscuits in their individualized packets, individualized shampoos, that's like the extreme to me of an economy that is seeking to get profit at the highly individualized level. We need to change that, and we need to move to an economy which is about collective consumption as far as possible. Economies of scale there as well. It's about looking at the long-term circularity of products. And of course, within all of that, there needs to be a, what I call a radical redistributive element to all of that, because the context of the climate crisis is, and the general ecological crisis is, that is happening in a world, as we know, of absolute gross, obscene inequalities. And that, when you start to go in that direction, it has to be about taxation, and it has to be wealth taxes, and it has to be about looking at how you protect those who are in the most vulnerable situations from the costs of transition. Because there is a cost to transition, especially when it comes to energy.
And if you think of like housing is a great example, which potentially could both address climate change and help a just transition. Like, for example, and the retrofitting is a great example. Like, even the grants that are provided are not sufficient to genuinely, you know, develop passive houses, that everybody could develop those. And I know, like, it's within the ideas of the Green New Deal. But I think for us in the Irish context, there's a huge opportunity. We need to build hundreds of thousands of homes. We're going to build them in the coming years.
Well, Leonie, look at O'Devney Gardens yesterday. O'Devney Gardens, social housing structure now, and they're talking about the cost of the actual houses that will be there now if this new development proceeds will be 425,000. They're not affordable homes. So that's like, we are totally screwing up this whole model. And the one thing I would come back, Lorna, and it's because language matters, is when we say things like degrowth, we put a lot of people off because they think immediately, oh, I find it tough enough. I couldn't have less.
Yeah.
But what we mean by that is actually when, you know, you have someone like Keen McMahon in The Economist, and he tells you about cooperatives and how actually by reducing that, the CEO who earns 150 times what the entry level is, it actually is better for everybody. So we need to make.
And know, I mean, I think that's why it's about distribution.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, because there's plenty of room for degrowth in a redistributed, if wealth is redistributed.
Oh, I know. I just know. Yeah. I know some of the journalists who listen to these podcasts will jump up and down and go, degrowth. I told you they want us to have less. And
but it's also how you measure growth. That growth currently is measured via consumption, the level of consumption in the economy.
Yeah.
And this is the problem, that our focus on GDP growth as measuring consumption is actually measuring destruction of the environment. And it's,
of course.
Whereas if you looked at things like well-being, which there's increasingly emphasis on. So look at, for example, measuring the growth of society, we should be replacing with the development of society. Yeah. How is well-being improvement? How are health outcomes, housing, education outcomes? How are, you know, is the productive capacity of society to produce, you know, people who have a better health for fulfilling their ambitions and potential? There's a whole shift to measuring growth differently.
Yeah, and I mean, there is, like, I mean, even when you do that, there is a strong correlation between economic growth and human happiness. Like, so it's not straightforward, because
until you reach the point, as Richard Wilkinson points out, in terms of, as we have reached, that countries start becoming more and more unequal.
Of course.
And
of
then
course.
Growth equality doesn't matter. Actually, equality
absolutely
matters.
It matters to a point.
Yeah.
And growth matters a lot more if you're in the lower levels of income.
Yes.
So the relative growth matters very significantly if you are struggling to survive and if you don't have a roof over your head. That is.
But if your growth is measured as the GDP increase and not as, for example, the provision of affordable housing, the provision of healthcare,
absolutely,
if you're in lower income groups, what matters more is a due of access to affordable housing, affordable quality healthcare, education, you know, all these public transport.
It matters more that you have a safety net and you have a well-functioning society.
Yeah.
When you're in the lower income brackets. Mm. And then as you go up.
And increasingly the middle class as well.
And increasingly the middle classes. But it's above a certain threshold. There's diminishing returns on, let's say, income in terms of human happiness.
Yes.
Although I'm sure multimillionaires would probably, individual ones would disagree with that. But it's been shown, like when they do these studies, that there's diminishing returns in terms of societal, let's say, happiness and well-being.
One of those put a figure in the US, and it put the figure, it was actually quite low. It was a scarily low. Like they said, once you're over $117,000 per annum, it starts to slide significantly. And the slide starts, they reckon, after the $88,000 mark or whatever. And you're looking at it going, okay, so the happiest people were somewhere in that window from 88 to 115. I know it sounds like a lot of money, but it, you know.
But also, though, you have to, and this is Richard Wilkinson's interesting point about inequality, which is that if you, even the richest people in deeply unequal societies actually do worse than richer people in more equal societies, because everybody suffers from social crime, from, you know, the stress that there's across the board. And you can transfer that idea to climate, that, okay, we could have, you know, the wealthy can survive climate change, but everybody, and even those in middle incomes can survive and those, but we, as you talked about, we're all starting to suffer from eco-anxiety, from, you know, seeing the impact, concern about most of people are getting deeply concerned. It is affecting us because we are part of society. We are part of a planet. Most of us feel that. And so the question is then, how is that collective concern transferred into a major change that can actually provide hope?
Yeah, and I think
change.
It has to, I mean, it has to translate into political choices then. And I mean, I think that's the challenge, is do people, is there the leadership from a political level to kind of make this a top priority, not in a greenwashing sense, but in a really significant way, that this becomes an overarching theme, let's say, for political, for political groupings. I mean, that's not to me just about saying, oh, everybody vote for the Green Party. And like, so it's about looking across the political spectrum and saying, what's their approach in terms of the kind of measures, urgent measures that are needed to reduce our emissions and to address the inequality and the sectors that are most affected by that transition. And I mean, I come back to the whole thing, like it needs, like where are the spaces for those conversations? How are those difficult conversations going to happen? And where's the political attention? And we know that like we cannot afford to have another decade like of saying, I mean, I can see it coming down the tracks with Brexit and saying, oh God, like 5 years time, another climate plan, looking back and going, ah, well, Brexit happened. We lost another 5 years. We can't afford to lose another 5 years. Scientists have said in the most recent report, which was the 1.5 degrees report of the IPCC, that it was last autumn. So they were saying there were 12 years left in terms of the dramatic reductions in emissions that need to happen by 2050. But actually, because of the lag of the time it takes to bring about political change, social change, the actual window is the next 2 years. And yous know that because, like, in terms of the work that you do, Rory, in terms of public policy and systems and like, if you think how long we've been talking about change in the HSE, for example, like, and how long it takes, it's just a fact.
Systemic change
and the kinds of changes we are looking for the climate change are energy systems. They're retrofitting of houses, they're public transport, these take time. It takes
the
time
reduce to consumption, to, changing the consumption
to,
model
to rank up the ratchet up the to change the consumption model, but also to ratchet up the industrial processes that are needed and to put the investment into those. So 2 years. I mean, people now in the climate movement are saying, well, maybe we have to actually get out. And this is the eco-anxiety thing comes in, because we have to get our heads around perhaps the fact that we that climate change is here. It's happening. The impacts are going to be severe. We need to work not to give up our fight, but we have to accept a certain level of change is going to come. And we also have to work to bring about that system change as like within in a very short time frame. I mean, I think the things that are giving me hope, apart from Greta Thunberg and all the youth, and hopefully next week millions of people across the world on the streets. The International Congress of Trade Unions came out yesterday.
That's right, I saw
in support
that, yeah.
of the strikes. And hopefully the Irish unions will come out as well. I know Forces come out, SIPTU's come out. Hopefully others, like the teaching
unions.
So will
they actually be walking out on strike as well?
I'm not sure how it's going to work. The Forces statement is very much encouraging. They're not encouraging their members to strike, but showing solidarity and support with the children who are striking, and suggesting that people use their lunch break to come out on strike or to come out with the young people. It would be great now to see some unions actually tabling this as a motion and to encourage their members to come out on strike. I mean, I think that the call for a general strike on the climate emergency is one that I think is really needed at this stage. It's not going to happen, I don't think, next week. Maybe there can be some kind of sea change in public opinion in a week. There's the starts of it. The first workers, let's say, to say they're going to come out on strike, are the Amazon.
Yeah.
In San Francisco, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Given their namesake. Yes. I thought. So the 900 workers are going to walk off the job next Friday.
900 drones will come in.
But yeah, so there's signs of hope, and the next 6 months are going to be critical.
And there's events in October then as well, isn't there?
So we have but Naomi Klein is coming to Ireland. So she's going to be launching her new book, On Fire: The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, in the National Stadium on the 18th of October, and I'm going to be interviewing her.
That's
really
right.
Cool.
Looking forward to. Yeah. Is there still tickets available for that?
I believe there are. Okay. Yeah, they're on the Dublin International Literary Festival website. If you look up Naomi Klein Dublin, people can find them. I think that's really about shifting this conversation. The urgency is real. We know it's happening. Let's really get to grips now with the whole issue of what would a Green New Deal look like for Ireland? And I think Naomi Klein, I mean, she's one of the people I've followed for many years and inspired me. She can really help us, I think, in this conversation, being here to start to say, all right, well, what would the parameters, what would the kind of key kind of things we need to look at in terms of the Green New Deal in the Irish context. But then it's like we need the spaces to get in a room and to have those conversations. And they have to include everybody.
Ivan and what's his name, Matt Cooper, will probably have you on for, you know, on TV3 in their late night show or maybe prime time. Give a half an hour discussion to a circular economy.
Love to do that.
But listen, Lorna, so there's Naomi Klein is coming over, and then there's also further protests as well, which in October, is that right? Is there?
There's the Rebellion Week.
Yes, Rebellion Week.
So that's the second week in October, yeah. I believe.
And then the Fridays for Future.
Fridays for Future will continue
every Friday.
We had a little bit of a lull over the summer, but some wonderful young people kept the flame burning.
Yeah.
The entire summer, we're still out every week in Maynooth.
Yeah.
That's still going strong. And then I'm going to be delivering the Donald Nevin lecture.
That's right, yeah.
I've actually forgotten.
That's okay. People can look it up. It's in
mid-November sometime.
Yes, the economic website. But hopefully we'll be in conversation with Naomi Klein if we're lucky. And
you'd stop chancing your arm. he thinks she's more important.
You want to get her up here on the sofa.
Exactly, yeah. We'll get her in here and you can interview her.
Sure,
but listen, Lorna, thanks so much for coming in to join us. It was
fantastic
and it's really important. I would really encourage people to get out in whatever way you can and show your support on Friday, the 20th.
FOE.ie has all of the locations and the events that are happening. There's stuff happening across the country, across the globe, actually. There was over 2,000 the last time this happened. So, you know, hopefully be bigger. That's what I'd say to you folks. That is the only way, as the kids like to shout, what is it? System change, not climate change.
And as always, folks, we need people to sign up on Patreon. Become a patron, support the Tortoise Shack, Reboot Republic and the other podcasts that are here. We really need your support to keep going, to fund us. If you like what we do, if you enjoy listening, please dig in and support us. Thank you.